This is netstat.fm, your weekly podcast about networking, Rust, and everything in between. You are listening to episode 22, recorded on January 9th, 2026, where Glenn has a conversation with Simu Sapang, one of the engineers behind Serpo. Together, they look at real-world URL implementation in Rust and explore where the most important design boundaries appear.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another week of NetStable.fm. This week is the first time we will touch some amazing servo technology, and I have the perfect guest to help us unpack all the URL crates in this project. So welcome, Simon.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
So Simon was one of the original developers on the Rust URL crate and the related subcrates. But before we dive into the technicalities, can you maybe introduce yourself a bit, Simon?
Sure. I'm a software developer based in France, and I've been doing Rust for quite a long time. Study 2013 when I joined Mozilla to work on Servo. Before that, my first job was working on WheezyPrint, which is a project that turns web pages into PDF. So if you want to print things or archive things, PDF file format can be helpful. But the company I was at, they really wanted to use web technologies. It's a tiny company, and they hired me basically to make what is mostly a web rendering engine. So it's implementing CSS. And that got me involved with web standards and CSS implementation. And later I applied to Mozilla and joined the Servo team. So that's how I got involved. And I happened to work on the URL crates because we needed that at the time for Servo. But my background is mostly CSS layout and rendering, more than networking.
So you said that your background was originally in more like rendering. And
that's right, and CSS layouts.
And I know in Servo there are also several, like, I mean, that's one of the big things it had in the beginning was around CSS engine and those kind of things. Is that also how you were involved in Servo?
Yes, exactly, actually. there was a time where Servo used an existing library for CSS computation from the NetSurf project. NetSurf is a browser project, I'm not sure exactly, written in C, and they have some components available as separate libraries. But that was limited for a bunch of reasons, and several projects wanted to have something in Rust. And at my previous job, I had written a CSS parser before in Python. So I thought to myself, that's a good opportunity to learn Rust, and I'm going to learn Rust and write a CSS parser in Rust. And so I applied to Mozilla and came to a job interview with an implemented parser. So that was a bonus for me, I guess.
Very nice. And I know they also have like things like selectors. Like I'm not sure what the crate name is, but I'm pretty sure they
also have
to select based on CSS selectors and I guess export and that kind of stuff.
That's right. And so I guess my approach was successful because Mozilla hired me. And after I joined the team, we realized that the parser is good, but it's not enough because the NetSurf CSS library does also style computation, dealing with selectors and cascading and all of those aspects of CSS. And so we got to work in implementing the rest of it, including selectors. And that became what we sometimes call stylo. And after some development, it ended up also being used inside Firefox. And that project was also called Quantum CSS. So around 2017, you may have heard of Firefox Quantum, which was a push to add several components written in Rust inside Firefox. And they are still in use today.
Yeah, very cool. So there is definitely, anyway, too much like server quality stuff to unpack in one episode.
Yes.
And I definitely want to one day touch on the CSS bits, especially related to the selectors. Or is it, by the way, related? Is it like the same crate doing the, I mean, does the crate that implements the selector stuff also, is that used in the rendering bit, or is it like totally separate?
So the selectors crate is used by Servo and Firefox today, but it's not directly involved in rendering. It's more upstream of the computation where you have a bunch of style sheets and you have a DOM document tree, and you want to apply style sheets to the documents and get computed CSS values based on all the selectors and style sheets. So that's a bunch of computation that happens kind of ahead of rendering. And then based on that, the CSS layout is going to create a rendering tree.
Very cool. So when you joined, it was basically all about the CSS and the rendering, etc. It's very exciting. But what I want to now narrow down a bit to is like Rust URL. And I wonder, was it already started at that point, or that came much later?
It was a bit early in my history, I guess, with the server projects. I don't remember what year exactly, but we can look it up, the early commits. And the way it happened is basically the Rust ecosystem was fairly young at the time. So there wasn't yet a library dealing with URLs in Rust, and we needed it for Servo, for networking, but also dealing with the links and href inside documents, that kind of things. And also the Watt working group, which is the standardization body that came up with HTML5. They also have other specifications for web-related things, including one for URL. And so there was a specification already available, oriented for the web, basically telling us everything we need to know about how to do things. So basically, I took that specification and started writing Rust code, doing what it says to do.
And how was that experience like? Like, based, I mean, let's say you implement the spec, and based on that, I imagine you also go up with test cases. Was it fairly straightforward, or did it collide a lot with the real world, let's say?
The implementation was fairly straightforward because of the style of web working group specification. They tend to like to have algorithms written in English in sort of pseudocode, but explicit steps with fully details about what to do. And in particular, they also tend to define error handling. So for any inputs, byte sequence or string, Unicode string, basically the spec should tell you what to do. That's the design goal of the spec, even if it's invalid input. It will tell you exactly which inputs are invalid or not, and what kind of error. And that's a design philosophy that came from HTML5, where previous to that, HTML was de facto a permissive language where some things are valid or invalid, but if you make mistakes, the browsers will still try to recover and still display the document as best as they can. But different browsers were doing different things, so interop wasn't great until the HTML5 project started to fully define HTML parsing, including error handling. And that was the foundation of the Watt working group.
Okay, perfect. And then are we at that point only talking about the core URL crate, or what was exactly implemented at that point?
the project of RustURL started as take the spec and write code to do what it says. And it was a single crate to begin with, but over time some components were separated out, like personal coding, because something, I think it might be forms or something else, wanted to use personal encodings outside of URLs. And then at first there wasn't any IDNS support, but when we added that, it made sense to make it a separate crate because it's a fairly well-defined boundary of API. And for IDNA, it's the Unicode Consortium, which is a different standards body that defines IDNA and algorithms to implement.
Okay, perfect. And let's say, okay, you have the URL thing. What year are we talking then, by the way? difficult one.
I don't remember exactly, but would have been between 2013 and maybe 16. There's a commit in 2016, which is about split IDNA into a separate crate. So I guess initially it was inside the crate.
Okay. And so now that we have this, so we had the URL core crate, but then right now, if you would look at the RustURL repository, there's also things like percent encoding, which is used for the encoding of data that is not like URI compatible, let's say, like if you have special characters or whatever.
Right.
And then you have like form URL encoded, which is like for example, if you're posting form data, like how that's encoded.
That's right.
When did these came, were they also already there and they were later separated out, or what's the story there?
So these two are both parts of the URL parsing algorithm, in the sense that if you have, let's say, HTML with a link and you use non-ASCII characters with accents or Chinese or whatever, in the path component, when turning that into a network request, the browser has to percent encode it, because the HTTP does not accept Unicode non-ASCII characters. So that is part of the URL parsing algorithm. So it was there from the start, and but maybe later split into separate crates for users who wanted to use that independently. And similarly for form URL encoded, that in URLs, it is used for the query component of the URL, which is after the question mark.
Yeah. And, let's say, for example, the percent encoding, was it always part of the initial spec of URL, or that came later?
It is part of the what working group specification, because for the browser point of view, if you have a form with method get, that will be turned into a URL where the different components of the form are part of the query component of the URL after the question mark. And that is the format with name equals fields and then the ampersand for other fields.
Okay. And then, I guess the form URL encode, that's pretty crucial to your use case as well, because, you're in the end all writing browse technology, and that's used a lot. But then we come to one that is relatively new, and that's like Aetna. Can you maybe like describe that a bit? Like, what is Aetna about and why it came into life?
Right. So Aetna, or IDNA, is coming from the Unicode Consortium, and its aim is to lift the limitation of which characters you can use inside domain names, because historically DNS is limited to ASCII letters and digits and the dash sign, and I think that's it. I'm not sure exactly. And that's mostly fine if you speak English, but in many other languages, there are either accented letters or completely different alphabets. And in the internationalization efforts that Unicode supports, it's nice to also be able to use all those alphabets inside domain names. So that's what IDNA tries to do, or does, rather. And the way it works is that you have the quote real domain name in quotes, which can use a number of Unicode characters. I think there are some limitations, but we can get to that. And that gets encoded into an underlying DNS name, which is only using ASCII letters and digits and dash, etc. And that encoding is called Punicode. And it looks like XN dash dash and then some other random looking letters and digits. And that's how you can layer on top of the existing DNS infrastructure with limited characters and add support for more characters.
Okay, that's pretty interesting. And I get that it might be nice, but also I guess it can make it a bit like complex for like to even like type. Well, I guess it will work. Let's say you are in that alphabet and you're used to it. I suppose you will anyway write it correctly, but I know that even with just like, let's say ASCII, like people already mistype URLs like plenty of times. If you start to involve like more complex names, I wonder how that will make the usability in one way or another.
Right, that is a concern, and it is something that the Unicode consortium has thought about and considered when designing IDNA. And that's why IDNA is not just Punicode, the encoding, because the encoding itself, it's just mapping numbers, which is the Unicode character numbers, to some ASCII strings. And it's a bit of math, and the algorithm, it's not super difficult. And it can end up relatively small. But then there are various concerns, such as different characters in Unicode that look like each other. They are called confusables. And that can be a security concern for phishing. Like if you go to your website, mybank.com, and some evil attacker registers the domain name that looks the same but uses the Cyrillic A instead of the Latin A for the AIM bank, it could potentially be a domain name that looks very similar, or maybe even looks exactly the same in some fonts. But it's a different website. And if you're not careful, you might get phished into giving sensitive information. And to avoid all of that, Unicode provides a sort of database of known confusable character pairs. And part of IDNA is looking for that kind of characters and in some cases rejecting. So some inputs are just invalid in IDNA. And I don't remember the details, but I think some of it is if you mix characters from different scripts, or that's what we call different alphabets, that is suspicious, and probably an attack maybe may not be allowed. I'm not sure of the details exactly, but it's this kind of thing. But that means that implementation of IDNA needs to carry around a bunch of data about many characters in Unicode, and you need to ship the database, sort of. And that means, in particular, for users of the crates like URL, if it includes IDNA, your binary size might get significantly larger to include of this Unicode database. And for some use cases, that's a concern. And in some of those cases, they don't necessarily care about having IDNA or about untrusted input that could intentionally use confusable, or they might prefer not to have this big database of characters.
And that means that there's like, I mean, that's a similar concern as UTF-8 in general, no? That you would need like an entire set of glyphs or whatever with you if you want to support like the raw parsing of UTF-8 or something?
Well, UTF-8 itself is pretty simple in terms of, it's just a bit of math of if you have a character ID that is above, I don't remember what hexadecimal number, then instead of 1 byte, you will need 2 bytes or 3 or 4 bytes to encode one character or one technically Unicode scalar value or code point. So UTF-8 itself is relatively simple, but then some other Unicode related things can require a database of characters. For example, if you want to have something in uppercase or lowercase, if you want to change something to uppercase or lowercase, in the ASCII world, it's pretty simple. There's just one range to map to another. But if you want to do it correctly for any language, it requires more data to know the different mappings. And annoyingly, it's actually different depending on the language, like some characters map differently. So this kind of higher level operation on Unicode text, some of them require a database of characters that increase code size.
Yeah, yeah. And then, yeah, so I can understand why it's important, again, to be within the REST URL space, because in the end it's still for browsers, and now people will start to use these domains, and so you need to be able to parse them and interpret them correctly.
Yes. So for a time, we had a number of people who were saying, like, we don't really care about IDNA and it's adding code size for us, but we would still like to use URL. And for a time it was, it's not really a solution to just remove it for everyone. And later, this was after I was not really involved in the project anymore, but these days it's Henry Sivonen, who I think is still at Mozilla, who kind of took over that part of the project, the IDNA crate. And Henry introduced a mechanism where there's an intermediate crate called IDNA underscore adapter, I think. And what it does is let the end user of the crate at the application level choose between different implementations of IDNA using cargo feature flags. Maybe not feature flags, but different versions. I don't remember the details, but there is a documentation that explains all of it and how to use it. And there's a choice of implementation between, I think, two different sets of libraries dealing with Unicode that have different trade-offs. But also there is a third choice, which is like the do-nothing implementation, which does not actually implement IDNA. And that means you don't have to pay for the code size of shipping character databases for use cases that where that's not relevant. But the trade-off, of course, is that you can't deal with Unicode characters in DNS, and you also don't implement some of the security checks related to confusable or other phishing concerns that that IDNA prevents or tries to prevent.
Yeah, but of course, for some use cases, that might be okay, especially if no human is involved in the
Right, if all of your input is trusted, for example.
Yeah, and then I know, yeah, URLs, okay, one thing, but they also contain domains, and then domains we enter DNS territory. And as far as I know, the WAT working group is mostly concerned around browsers, but I guess they also deal with DNS RFCs. Was there like a big corporation in there, like how to deal with it from a DNS point of view?
So there is a sort of separation of concerns where the URL specification written by the WAT working group defines parsing and error handling for many parts of URLs. But as far as DNS and in particular IDNA is concerned, the WAT working group spec does not duplicate everything Unicode does, but instead they reference the specification from Unicode. So if you want a full implementation of the WAT working group URL specification, you also need by reference to go look into Unicode specifications and implement some of those for IDNA.
Okay. And so what does a registrar seal? I mean, what if I want to register in a domain register like an IDNA compatible domain? Do I enter there also? Most people will do it via web GUI or whatever. Will they enter like just a Unicode variant and it will translate them to this ASCII format and that's all that will be in the record, or how do I see that?
Yeah, so IDNA has been around for a number of years now, so I would guess almost every register supports it, and they make it so that in the human interface, when you register your domain, you type whatever you want with Unicode character, and it will tell you if that character is allowed or not. And I think there may be restrictions based on which top-level domain you choose as well, but I'm not sure. That's a decision of the organizations that manage each top-level domain. And if your domain is acceptable and compatible, then the register will take care of translating that into Punicode and doing the necessary steps. But then if you look under the hood and run some diagnostic tools like the host command or dig command, most likely you will see the encoded version in Punicode. And unless those tools themselves, they implement IDNA to decode.
Yeah, yeah, I see. And then you said there were restrictions. For example, Unicode also contains emojis. Can I register emoji domains like that?
That's a great question, and I don't know. You'll have to check. I don't remember seeing any emoji domains, so I probably not, maybe not.
Yeah, that's true. But at the same time, even though you said it's around since a couple of years, I also don't really see any other, like, what I would consider IDNA territory kind of domains. Like now that I know about it, I started looking for it, and yeah, I can find some examples. But I must say, I never saw it on my radar before.
Right. I would guess that's because at the register level, this is their job, so they are well prepared now to deal with it. But in the rest of the world, many pieces of software don't always deal with it very well. And I don't have much experience with that either, but it's possible that, especially in the early years, if you do use an IDNA domain, you might encounter bugs in various different software that tries to handle your domain. Or maybe some of them will reject your domain saying that's not valid because they are only filtering and accepting the ASCII characters. And I would guess, at least at first, because of those limitations in other software, people tend to avoid doing it and they stick to what is compatible with everything, which is ASCII. And that slows the adoption. I would hope at least that over the years those kind of bugs tend to be fixed or limitations, and more software implements IDNA and does it correctly. So if you do want a domain name with Unicode characters and IDNA, it's probably fine nowadays, but I guess the adoption wasn't that great. And another factor is that you and I speak English and other languages that use the same alphabet. So if we want to write names in ASCII, it's mostly okay. And it's not as much of a difference from how we usually write. But compared to other languages, like if you write Arabic every day, having to convert your name into a Latin character that's kind of out of place, more so than English, I guess.
Yeah, I understand. So maybe in those territories already used more as well, I imagine. Okay. And so then if we step a bit back and start to dive into the core URL crate, because like I said, we talked with Larry Macinter before, and we got like a nice like philosophical point of view in it and the background, but we didn't get a chance yet to look into an implementation. And for sure, REST URL is not the only implementation. Like another known implementation is the one from Hyper. Like they also have their own URL implementation, which I guess came later.
Right.
And so, yeah, even though I do wonder, but I guess that's not for you to answer, unless you do have an answer, it's like, I wonder why they then wouldn't have maybe started with the REST URL crate of Servo, which seems fairly compatible anyway, but I'm sure there's a good answer there.
So, I think the root of those differences is kind of the design philosophy or scope of the White Working Group specifically. And what White Working Group is concerned with the web and specifying what web browsers need to do to be compatible with each other. And so there is a very specific point of view of parsing a URL means parsing the href attribute of an A element in HTML. And that gets turned into an HTTP request. But it's not so much concerned about what HTTP servers need to do, for example. And that means there are some use cases that are not served ideally by the White Working Group spec of URL. And the scope of the project of REST URL is at least initially defined by implementing that specification from White Working Group. And that means dealing with everything a web browser needs, but if someone else needs something that is different or not quite compatible, there is tension there on how to deal with that. And in some cases, if it's just an additional API that can be added on top, that's fine. But if you want different behavior, for example, it's more tricky, like how to deal with that in one project. Do you have a feature flag that switches between different behaviors? Besides behavior, there may be differences in design of what a URL even is, what is part of it or what is not part of it. And I don't know all of the details, but I think that is part of the reasons why Hyper did not choose not to use the URL crate and they went with something else, because they have constraints from HTTP when trying to be compatible with every other HTTP client or server in the world. There's different set of constraints in terms of what is valid or what is invalid.
Yeah, I understand. Yeah, it's also what Larry said. Is like he said that nobody can really agree anyway what the URL is, and we tried to unpack it a bit. And of course, you have the data URL for which you also have a create.
Yeah.
Which is that the same as the blob scheme? Because I can see in your code that you also have like scheme blob. Is that also the data URL or is it something else?
That's different. So the data URL, the idea is that everything you need is contained inside the URL itself. And instead of making a network request, you just have some algorithm that decodes stuff. And the contents of the URL, the data, you put it literally in there, either encoded as base64 or not encoded at all. But then the URL itself has percent encoding. So if you don't use base64, you effectively use percent encoding instead for characters that don't normally appear in URLs. So you have the data directly in there, and that means if you have a lot of data, you have a very long URL, which can be okay up to a few kilobytes, but if you have many megabytes of URLs, some systems don't deal with that very well, or maybe it can be slow or whatever. And blob is a separate thing where I'm not super familiar with it. I don't know all the details of how it works, but I think the core idea is that you don't have everything inside the URL. You don't have megabytes of data directly in there, but instead you have unique identifiers. It may be a UID, I'm not sure. And that refers to some blob of data somewhere in the software that is created by a different API. But refer to by ID, basically.
Okay. That's interesting because it's also something he was referring to as something he wants to be done. So I guess it's partially there already.
Yeah.
And then, of course... Yeah, go for it.
Earlier, you said nobody can agree what your URL even is. And I think that's true. But it's also a philosophical difference, I would say, where the white working group tries to come up with an answer, and they would say a URL is this, at least in some context. And maybe that's not the right answer for everybody, but it is an answer, and that answer is well defined and precise. And as an implementer, what I find frustrating sometimes with specifications or RFCs from IETF, especially the older ones, is that they describe, I'm paraphrasing, this is what a URL looks like, and maybe there is a grammar, for example, in BNF, something like that, and the grammar itself is precise, but then what happens if you are passing inputs that does not match the grammar? How do you deal with that? And in many RFCs, that's kind of not really considered, or it's left up in the air. And that's where the white working group specifications try to be different and give you an answer on how to deal with stuff.
But often the answer is just try to be as graceful as possible. No, I mean, like it's basically maybe ignore it or somehow, like, yeah, because in the end it's browsers, right? So they're very forgiven.
Yeah. So in the world of standard and interoperability, there is something. Let me just check that I'm not confusing the name. Right. Something called Postel's Law, also known as the robustness principle. And the idea is that you're trying to have different software talk to each other, and sometimes there's bugs. And to deal with those situations and be compatible, the idea of Postel's Law is try to be permissive in what you accept, but strict in what you emit. So when you're passing stuff coming from someone else, try to recover from errors. But when you serialize or emit stuff in different file formats or protocols, try to be as strict as possible and only stick to valid documents or items or things. The problem with that idea is that try to recover from errors is not well defined. And if you just say try and everybody tries independently, they come up with different things that may or may not be compatible with each other. And if you are also permissive in what you accept, that means even stuff that is nominally invalid according to the spec, people are going to start relying on that, because that's how ecosystems work, basically. If something, if the software behaves in a certain way or accepts some inputs, some people are going to start relying on that, even if it's officially wrong. And if you change it later to say, no, that's wrong, and we're going to break that in that case, well, stuff in the real world is going to start breaking. And in a lot of cases, it means you can't really do that. So the invalid stuff ends up becoming de facto valid and the way people do things. And in my opinion, it's better to try to specify from the start how errors should be handled by everyone, instead of leaving up to every implementation to figure out different ways to do it and ways that may be incompatible with each other.
Yeah, yeah. I do like that, and that's totally fair. And then I see that there's also FTP and file support, where like file is just your there is no origin or a path, but it's just your file path. And right. Then is there much difference between an FTP URL and let's say an HTTP URL?
FTP and HTTP are very similar to each other. It's just the default port number is going to be different. But in terms of parsing, as far as I remember, at least, they should be identical, but there may be some special cases.
Does FTP also support query and like fragment parts, or that's like not there?
At the parser level, I think yes. But at the protocol level, I don't think there is anything like query in the FTP protocol. So my guess would be it's silently dropped when you make the request. But the fragments, however, is client-side. It's in a browser where after making the request and getting a document, the fragment designates a particular part of the document. So that's independent of the protocol. But these days, that's kind of moot because every browser has removed support for FTP. I guess HTTP is the only protocol universally supported by browsers.
And of course, like WebSocket, that's HTTP URLs anyway, so just a difference.
Yes, that's right. There is that as well. And file is a more special case because different operating systems have different syntax for file paths, like the backslash versus forward slash. So there is a bit more of a special casing in the parser to resolve that.
Yeah, indeed. But cool. And so that's, I guess, the more interesting aspect for me to when I mean like what's the URL even about, what my main concern mostly is let's say I'm the implementer of some network library and I want to support a URL kind of thing as a concept. What I would like to avoid is for each protocol to have like a separate implementation, because yeah, in the end they all look very similar, but there are details which are different. Here, of course, they are quite similar. I mean, there are three distincts here, like blob, FTP, blob, HTTP, and then file, okay. But from a network point of view, you mostly care about the HTTP point of view. But then, as far as I know, I had a conversation in the podcast with Daniel from Curl, mm-hmm. and that's a client library as well as a CLI tool. And they deal with basically everything that has a URL, and that's like a whole lot of protocols.
Yeah.
And so I just wonder, like, that's for me more the harder question, like what's similar there and what's different, because in the end, if you don't look at close enough, they all look so alike.
Yeah, so I think that in general there is a desire to have a mechanism that is generic and works for every protocol, and the Euron spec at One Cracking Group and the Euron crates, they try to do that in having, if you have a URL with a scheme, that is the protocol part. If it's unknown, there is a code path and a path in a specification to handle generic protocols. And that means we don't need to have baked in support for every protocol on Earth in the library. And ideally, every protocol would work the same way, but for compatibility with existing systems, there are some special cases we need to deal with file, for example.
I see. And so, is there also a principle in the URL crate to try to, I don't know, like share as much data in a single blob as possible and just work with kind of like ranges where you say, like, I don't know, maybe the origin is this size, maybe the port is in this location, or do you also already have the parsed version available?
Right. So part of what the URL parser does is taking a single string as input and splitting the different components. And which components exist is kind of the fixed data model of what a URL even is. And that means you get to have a scheme, you get to have a domain, a path, a query, a fragment. And if you are designing a new protocol and you want URLs, it's a good idea to make your URLs look like that. There is a scheme that's going to be the name of your protocol, and the domain probably goes to DNS. And the path, maybe you use it or you don't use it. And similarly, maybe you want parameters in the query. And if you're designing something new, trying to fit into that model means you can use existing URL libraries.
Yes. And then, okay, so we have that. Because I think last time we already kind of went over what a URL is. We talked about it as a scheme. It has like the username part, which like maybe also a password, but that's like rarely used except for some proxies. You have the host, which can be a domain or an IP, IPv4, IPv6. You have the port number, then you have the path, then behind the question mark, if there is any, there is the query, and then behind the hashtag, there is the fragment, which is, as far as I know, a client-only thing.
That's right.
Yeah. What are the rules, by the way, for what can be after the fragment? Is it also like URL encoded? I guess so.
That's a good question. I don't remember. I think the if you're passing the href inside HTML, and depending on which characters you use, some of them may be URL encoded by the parser. But then there is also an API to in a URL crate to decode it and get the decoded string that you would use to match against the document to find the actual piece corresponding to the fragment.
Okay. And then you said, okay, if there's not a scheme found, which means like the protocol, that we might treat it as like an opaque like URL, like some generic thing.
Yeah,
but there is also the concept of the port. Like, what if it's defined? Would you also consider that as a valid alternative for the scheme? Like, let's say it's 443. Would you then say like it's an HTTPS thing, or you wouldn't go that far?
Yeah. So the port number is also a thing that exists in the data model, in the sense of what is a URL. That is one component, and for the URL crate, at least in the generic case for an unknown scheme, you can have a port number, But we don't know the default value of the port number. So in terms of REST API, it's going to be an option that it will return if you ask for the port number. But compared with HTTP, for example, where we know that for HTTP, the default port, if you don't specify it, is 80, and for HTTPS, it's 443. And I don't remember exactly. I think there is a different API to tell you specify port number or the default, something like that.
Okay. And so then if we zoom in on the port one, which I find very interesting, what does the what specification tell about like case sensitivity? I imagine it says it's case sensitive, or am I wrong there?
That's a good question. I think for the path, it's gonna not change anything. So whatever you put in the input is gonna be left as is. That is probably different for DNS.
Yeah, but that's of course the host part, which is a different part. Even though I'm pretty certain that domains are also case sensitive. I don't think you can just register, I don't know, google.com in capital letters. I don't think that's a thing. I'm pretty certain you it's a case sensitive thing as well.
I think you can. It's insensitive in the sense that it's all going to be folded into the same.
Yeah. That's what I mean. But I mean, it's not like I can register some capital variation of that.
Right, because it's going to be considered the same name. For the path components, as far as I remember, it's not going to be converted to lowercase or anything like that. But then it's up to the server or other components to decide whether they consider it the same path or not.
Okay, so that is left up to the server. That's what I thought, because many servers will just see it as strings, and so they might not, they might give you a 404 if you have the wrong casing.
I think it's usually not considered the same path. So if you have different case, it's going to be 404. But some servers may just pass the string to whatever file system they use. And if the file system happens to be case insensitive, then they will do that.
Okay, too bad. Like, because like, for example, the HTTP, let's say headers used to be case sensitive, and then only since HTTP2, they said like, no, everything is lowercase, and I think that was a huge benefit, because also before you could have like, I don't know, some proxy which like was having like, I don't know, maybe the some kind of like first letter casing of every word or every part instead of the original casing, and you could get into weird issues where the server certainly didn't recognize your headers, and then since HTTP2 everything was lowercase, I would have thought that it might make sense to also just force lowercase there. But then of course, maybe not, because again, what is a URL?
Yeah, so that goes back to the design philosophy of how you want to design protocols and whether you should be permissive in what you accept or not. And HTTP2 decided to be more strict.
Okay, fair enough. And so, as you dove quite deep into the protocols of URL, because you implement them, I'm sure, several iterations, are there like some things you learned about URLs that maybe other people don't know about, and like things that surprised you, and that maybe some gems of knowledge you can share there?
I don't know about gems of knowledge, but I guess there's a surprising amount of special cases and things that need consideration. That on the surface, a URL that looks simple, but then if you actually want to be compatible with everything on the web, there's a bunch of things you have to deal with, and some of it is annoying, but that's life. We make the software that takes care of this so that hopefully our users don't need to.
Yeah. Fair enough. And do you remember something that seriously caught you off guard that you thought like, okay, I didn't know this was a thing or possible or should even be a thing, but it's something I need to support somehow.
I guess iDNA was the bit surprising in terms of size. Like, if you think about what is a URL and how much work is it to implement a library that deals with URLs, you can have some ideas initially. And even if you look at the RFC or specification, you can look how big it is and get some idea. But then you get to the parts about now you should probably deal with Unicode and IDNA. And what is a small paragraph inside this document is actually a link to another document that is huge. And there's a whole scope that you might not have anticipated with lots of complexity.
I see. And if we go to URL encoding, is that something? No. Percent encoding, sorry. So if you go to percent encoding, is it something that you should always... what does the specification say? Is it like, let's say you're writing a web router and you want to route on a pod. Should it always first percent encode, or are there like cases where you might say no? Here it should be checked as without being decoded.
The white working group spec defines a parsing algorithm where during parsing it will always encode some characters. Whereas, if I remember correctly, in the IETF RFCs, it's kind of undefined, where encoding is a thing that exists, but when you should encode or decode is not really talked about. And that's a choice that the white working group made for how browsers should behave. But if you're making something that's not a browser, maybe you would want to make different choices, I'm not sure. But there is also something that may be surprising, which is we think as URL encoding as one format, but it turns out inside the URL, the set of characters you want to encode or not encode is different depending on which component you're looking at. Like, for example, if you want to have a question mark inside of your path, well, normally the question mark marks the end of the path and the start of the query component, so you need to encode it if you want to have it be part of the actual path instead. But if you are inside the query itself, then the question mark, if you have another question mark, it doesn't have any special meaning, so you can just use it as is and you don't need to encode it. And
would it matter if you anyway encode it?
You can encode it and it will work out, probably. but you don't need to. And that's why in the crate for percent encoding, in the API, when you use it, it will take a parameter for, I think it's encode sets or something like that, to basically choose which characters you want to encode on it.
I see. Okay, that's indeed interesting. And then, I'm most surprised by how many different URL encoded like libraries there are in Rust. And of course, there's also a crate for that in Rust URL. But I guess yours is purely focused on, the browser point of view, right?
I think the explanation for that is that URL encoding itself is very simple as a format. And so if you are looking at the library that does it, but not exactly in the way you want it, it may be easier to just make another library or just implement a private module in your encode rather than make a super generic library. That's my guess for why there are many libraries doing it.
Yeah, that's fair enough, I guess. It's anyway very cool. I mean, I like the crate a lot. It looks very simple, and
yep.
I would suggest anyone that wants to learn a bit more about parsing I mean, it's definitely a beautiful code base to look through.
And that's a debate we have in general, in the Rust ecosystem, but in programming in general as well, about using a library versus implementing it yourself. And I think there's a lot of values in having libraries that are shared, used by different projects and maintained by different people together. And especially for more complicated stuff, sharing the implementation is good. But in some cases, for very simple stuff, like the overhead of having a separate project with a separate repository, with its own CI, with its own API, and its own semantic versioning compatibility concerns, that's a lot of things you need to deal with. And if it's just 50 lines of code that you could copy and paste in your code, sometimes that's a good solution too.
Yeah, that's true. But then again, I think you did you and your colleagues did a good job, because anyway, there's already like several crates. Like you have the IDNA crate, you have the percent encoding crate, and then even within the URL crate, actually that's not true. I thought you, can you use the URL crate just for parsing, or does it always end up that it only exposes the API for the actual URL? Because that's where I would think that you might start to see different preferences, where maybe as the raw URI parsing you can all agree, because it's basically just you want to find out which part of the string is what, but then how you want to represent it from there in memory, I think that's where you will start to see differences, because they might have their own host data types and their own, whatever way they want to represent these things. And I think, but the parsing itself, I would say that should be fairly, I guess people could share that, right?
Right. So the Rust URL crate provides both. It provides a parser and provides a struct, that is the parsed URL, where you can access each component. And if that in-memory representation works for you, then great, you can use it. And if it's not exactly what you want, then maybe your solution is to use it to parse, use the library to parse, and you get that representation, which is not the one you want, but then you can convert. That's a possible solution.
Yeah, and I think that's a very fair solution. And that's also why I wanted to, first of all, this crate is a very good way to learn more about URLs, and we learned a lot from you today. And secondly, I think it's also a crate that's not yet known by everybody, because especially people who come to Rust for networking, they will often move to, for example, the Hyper ecosystem, because it's so closely tied with Tokyo, and so they will see URL there, and it's used by a lot. And it's also a nice implementation, nothing wrong there. But I think it's nice to also learn about these other gems, and especially like Servo, as it's also so crucial to the Rust history. I think they did a good job there, and so I would like to thank you very much for your work, and also from your colleagues on this open source work. Like, it's greatly valued. I also wonder, now that this thing is there, and okay, we had it was developed originally for the Servo project in its first phase, but then there were the huge Mozilla layoffs, and then it was taken over again by another company, and now we are very happy that these things are maintained again. But at the same time, is there like a lot of work on these kind of crates, like once they are like kind of like finished? Because I wonder, if you take away things like IDNA, because maybe that's like a bit more like still a moving target, I would think that the other parts are fairly, and they could reach a point of being finished, right? Like, I cannot really see that they would still change that much.
Yeah, that's fair. That I think in every project there is an initial development phase that with a lot of activity, and then at least for some projects you reach a plateau where basically things work the way you want to, so you need to do as much evolution all the time. And probably the Rust URL crate is there and has been for some time. I haven't followed it very closely for a while, but
at present mean it's completely frozen, because there's still some amount of complexity and subtleties, and you can have bugs or improvements, but they're probably fairly minor compared to I don't expect a complete redesign of the crate anytime soon. So it's not quite the case of for a smaller project, you might imagine calling it completely done and basically not expect any change ever, because it's so small, as you can see, it does exactly what it needs to do. I think URL is a bit more complex than that, and it's good to still have maintenance and be able to respond to bug reports.
Yeah, fair enough. That's very cool. And so, with that work behind you, like, where are you now at that your life and the kind of, I don't know, let's say, what are your professional activities these days?
Yeah, so recently I was working at Apollo GraphQL, developing a GraphQL Federation router in Rust. And I left that job recently, but it was a very good team, and I really enjoyed working with these people. So I'm looking for work now. And if you have a Rust team who is hiring and is working in European time zone, I would be interested in hearing from you.
Very cool. And I would think there are, so I wish you the best of luck with that. And funny enough, we had like last episode, we had a guest from GraphBase, where they also work on a GraphQL federation. So I guess your work overlapped a lot there as well. That's very, very cool. Like I for example, because it was a very enlightening episode for me, because it was around GraphQL, and I learned about GraphQL at when it was like introduced and all this hype was around it, but then I kind of like didn't really follow anymore that space. And so I was pleasantly surprised to learn from him about this entire concept of federation, and it made like a lot of sense to me, where, yeah, I think that's something you really want, because it's a beautiful concept, but to do it all as a single team yourself, or to write one big, like, I don't know, API server that does GraphQL very well, is like, yeah, it's almost like an entire full-time activity in itself, which is very different from writing your typical REST API. And so this concept of a federation server, which does all the planning and optimizations and caching and whatever else you might want to do.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a beautiful concept.
Yeah, federation is pretty cool, and there is a lot of going on in implementing it, yes.
Yeah, and I also find interesting how then, yeah, for example, for Apollo, I learned from him that, and you can correct me because you worked at there, is that he said, okay, there are some companies that first started the federation server in something like TypeScript, and I think that's what Apollo did, and
yep,
then they transitioned it to Rust.
That's right. So at Apollo, they had a project called the Apollo Gateway, which was the initial implementation of federation in TypeScript. And that was useful for a bunch of people who were successful with it. But they ended up with huge deployments with many machines dealing with the traffic going through this TypeScript code base. And so some number of years ago, not long before I joined, Apollo decided to start building things in Rust. And so the Apollo router is a rewrite of the gateway, but in Rust instead of TypeScript.
Yeah.
And the team I joined was formed around that project and starting to use Rust at the company.
Okay. And I cannot stop myself from observing that you went from like working on rendering engines and on things like CSS, which is like related to there. Then you moved towards like more like network related stuff, which is then you, when you work on GraphQL and federation stuff, it's still that kind of world. Would you at some point ever want to move back to some kind of rendering? Because, I mean, it's a very different kind of way to program altogether, right?
Yeah, it's different ecosystems and different domains. And I joined Apollo knowing basically nothing about GraphQL, so that was interesting. Learned a lot. But I guess what I brought was more the experience with Rust. And even though it's different domains, there's a lot of things that end up being similar, like writing parsers, writing libraries with nice APIs that are used by different components, or what we call system level code or systems. That's a bit vague, the definition, but it's something.
Yeah, it's fair enough. And actually, you hit like a pet peeve of mine, because, yeah, I mean, I used to do a lot more on parsing compilers, and it's funny because at some point I wanted to join Mozilla and I could, but they couldn't hire me because I was in some really weird region in the world at that time that they couldn't like hire me from, and that would have been for the JavaScript engine team. And what I often tell people is, yeah, you should really learn to write parsers, because what I see often people like grabbing to is like just trying to do maybe some kind of, yeah, a very naive like string lookup, or they might use regular expressions, even though they don't even master regular expressions. And I think for some things, and I would include in their URLs and things like emails, and there are many of these examples, you really just want to have a parser, be it one that you can grab off the shelf of or write yourself, because it makes it so much easier, especially if all you care about is a specific part of that kind of like string, because your parser will be relatively small, because you can focus on just the first stage of the parser. And so it's a very valuable yep. skill to learn, I think.
That's right. And if you've never written a parser before, it maybe looks a bit scary, but I promise it's not too difficult. And especially if you look into something called recursive descent, that is a style of parser that I like to write. And it's very flexible and can do basically anything. And it's funny you mentioned compilers, because one of the projects I worked at Apollo is called actually Apollo Compiler. And it's kind of the foundational library for not only parsing, but everything around GraphQL, like having an in-memory representation that can be modified. And it's used by several different projects inside Apollo.
Yeah, I mean, these are very nice projects to work on, because they're usually pretty contained and you can test them very well. And you kind of like clear boundaries, like here's my input, which I totally do not trust. And you go to these different stages where you trust more and more. And like, I mean, it's a very nice waterfall kind of system where, like, if you do it with care and you don't rush it, like, it's a very nice thing to work on.
I agree. I enjoy this kind of work.
Yeah. Okay. Very cool. So that said, we discussed a lot. Like, I learned a lot about URLs. Obviously, we couldn't like discuss every single line of these crates, which neither is the intent. But I will definitely link it in the show notes. If you have some resources for people to learn more about this, it could be like the what spec, but also some other things. Also things like, let's say, oh, maybe if people want to learn this like parsing thing, they can look up this kind of sets. You can send them my way. Is there something else you would like to plug in the show before we round off?
If you haven't looked into Savo, it's pretty cool.
Very cool. And is there like a shout out you want to do to the like Rust community?
I really enjoy being part of the Rust community, and the Rust project in particular is something I've participated in, and I enjoy that as well. And kind of like writing parser, it may look scary, but if you want to get involved, I would encourage you to do it. And people there are very friendly and will help newcomers get started.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Thank you very much for your time today, Simon, and all the expertise you put in these projects.
NetStack.fm is brought to you by Plavio, building secure, open, and resilient infrastructure with Rust, protocols, and purpose. This show is also made possible by RAMA, the open source networking framework. Plavio offers service contracts and welcome sponsorships to keep building and supporting its ecosystem. The theme music of this podcast was composed by DJ Mailbox. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe on your favorite podcast platform and leave a 5-star review. It really helps others discover the show. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next time for the next handshake.